podcast this week. Winter is coming. Alex Winter, that is, as we chat to the director of the new Frank Zappa documentary, Zappa. And if winter is coming, it's a good time to go ice skating. So we talk to a man who has very firm views on such, particularly art of ice skating uphill. Coming to America star Wesley Snipes. Oh, yes, indeed. All that and more on the movie podcast that is slightly disappointed that Marvel didn't use its suggested title for Spider-Man 3. I don't know what was wrong with Spider-Man. Star Trek 4, The Voyage Home, apparently had already been taken or something, some sort of legal difficulties. Who knows? Who knows? Anyway, hello pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the Empire Podcast, back in my evil underground lair in London this week after my sojourn to Scotland last week. Oh, not Scotland. I shouldn't give away. Oh, it was Scotland. Anyway, this week I'm joined by three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Once again, geek queen Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Great big fucking nerd, James Dyer.
Yes, yes.
And the best thing to come out of Swindon since XTC, Beth Webb.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Is that like Swindon's most famous export?
Well, no, Billy Piper is.
Billy Piper?
What's an XTC?
What is XTC?
It's a sort of glam punk band from the 70s.
Yeah, Dad's a big fan. But no, Billy Piper was a few years ahead of me at Brayden Forest School, Swindon. So wow. Yeah, I would say she is probably the biggest thing in my eyes.
I take it back. Yeah, Mark Billy Lamar. Piper dwarfs XTs. Who?
Mark Lamar. Swindon.
Mark Lamar.
Melinda Messenger. Vivacia A. Fox. She was born in Swindon.
Well, she know an awful lot about people who came from Swindon. Like, I couldn't tell you who came from Pinner.
Well, it's just Swindon pride, isn't it? You just got to...
Oh, no, I can. So Pinner, the sinner from Pinner, Jane March, obviously came from Pinner. Do you remember this? Sinner
yes.
from Pinner?
No.
Yes, indeed.
From the Lover. And yeah. Colour of Night.
Indeed.
Where,
you don't need to fucking pause it. It's widescreen and his cock takes up the entirety of the screen. It is
a full HD,
massive Bruce Willis's bell end.
Like, 40 stories of sheer terror.
Yeah, absolutely that. It's like a poster for Die Hard, but on its side.
Oh dear.
Oh, this is all wildly inappropriate already. I'm so sorry. I'm so, so sorry. Hey, speaking of Billy Piper, did you know that if you're in central London and you're trying to figure out where you are in Soho and, you know, there's a run of streets. There's Greek Street, Fifth Street, Dean Street, mm-hmm. Poland Street, all that sort of stuff. There's an acronym, a handy acronym that you can remember to tell you the order in which the streets run. And that acronym is Going for Dinner with Billy Piper. G, going, Greek Street. Frith Street. Dinner, Dean Street. W, Wardour Street. B, Brewer's. Berwick Street. It's been a long time since I've been around these streets. And P, Poland Street. Going for dinner with Billy Piper.
That's amazing. I've never heard that. And
that's
I always
really
get the order
useful.
Of those streets wrong. So that's
yeah,
really useful.
I'm always lost.
That is not, by the way, my fact, because I don't do facts for the three fact structure. But if it had been, I think I would have won. But we're going to barrel straight into the three fact structure this week. Jimbo, you have promised a particularly long and tedious fact this week. It's going to leave you until the very, very end. Beth, as the occupant of the fourth chair this week, do you have a fact for the three fact structure? And if so, what is it?
It better involve Billy Piper.
I should come better equipped with Billy Piper facts for future. Here I am preloading on Swindon facts and not enough Billy Piper facts. Fact today is, it's a person. It is a woman called Lindsay Doran. Helen, I wonder if, I just assume, given you know everything about women in Hollywood.
Oh, everything, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely every single thing. there's a woman working in Hollywood. Her name is Lindsay Doran, and she is known as the script whisperer. And she is actually one of the better known people working on set. She's worked on some of the biggest films working today, and no one really knows who she is because she...
You just told us her name.
I know. She's very influential, and she's known as a script whisperer. And it's her mission in Hollywood to make Hollywood films happier. She used to be the president of United Artists Pictures. She was a producer on Ferris Bueller's Day Off and... Uh-huh. This is Spinal Tap and The Firm. And now she teaches these classes to these budding screenwriters on how to make happier films, basically. She's worked on Lord and Miller's films as well. But no one really knows who she is. She never gets credited on films. And I just think she's super interesting. And yeah, that's my fact.
So do we know what she looks like? Is she in cosplay as a giant script the entire time?
No, she's got this wild curly hair, and that's about all. She's kind of an enigma. You can do a little bit of Googling. There's like a New York Times article on her. I tried to talk to her for the magazine, but she is very shy and doesn't do a lot of press. But she's one of these kind of invisible women who is very present in Hollywood in a lot of ways, but doesn't actually get credited. Or
so does she just sort of turn up on like Die Hard 5 and go, needs more puppies, and that's yeah, that's her contribution.
If only that film had had more puppies, I think would be a very different thing.
She turns up a Color of Night and goes, put it away, Bruce, no one wants to see this.
no one needs this.
Well, one of the things she teaches is that it's not enough in a film for someone to triumph. They have to share the victory with someone. So like in the King's Speech, when he, you know, is able to deliver the speech, it's not enough that he's able to deliver the speech, it's that he's then able to share that victory with his family. When Baby does the big lift in Dirty Dancing, it's not enough that they carry off the big maneuver, it's then she does that and then she reconciles with her dad. So it's all those like key workings that she's kind of figured out through her years of working in cinema, and she's going on to teach this to kind of future generations. To prove that you don't have to make miserable movies to win Oscars, basically.
She didn't work on The Mist then.
She didn't work on The Mist. But she's this kind of one-woman mission, kind of working in Hollywood to try and make it happier.
That's cool. Oh, that's lovely. What a lovely, lovely...
Cockle-warming fact.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, very nice indeed.
Why does cockle-warming sound wrong when warm the cockles doesn't... I don't know.
I know what you mean. Yeah, it sounds dirty.
Contextually, because we were talking about Bruce Willis and this little lad.
His cockles were not warm. Yeah. That did not look...
Feels bad. Anyway. Okay. Hell's Bells, what have you got for us this week?
It was a little... I told you I got that Close Encounters book, so I thought I'd give you a little tidbit from that finally.
This is the Bob Balaban.
The Bob Balaban Diaries, Close Encounters Diaries.
They were Bob Balaban, but now Helen has got round the Bob Balaban.
I don't think they were. You may well know this, but I didn't know this before, which is that while they were shooting... What?
It's a film. Is that your fact?
No, that's a documentary. Oh, like, it's all there in the book. You know, it's all true. Aliens. Anyway, while they were shooting the real aliens, who definitely existed, on the big set in Alabama, there were reports of a guy going around L.A., claiming to be Steven Spielberg and basically conning people into paying for his dinner by claiming to be Steven Spielberg. And because everybody basically looked the same in the 70s, like everybody had the big beards and the glasses and they all looked the same, to the point where Bob Balaban and Richard Dreyfuss went to see Jaws together because Balaban hadn't seen it yet. But because Dreyfuss had shaved his beard and Balaban had grown one, people came up to them after the movie and asked Bob Balaban to sign their tickets because they thought he was Richard Dreyfuss. Anyway,
I mean, he doesn't even look anything like Richard Dreyfuss.
They do look alike. It was literally a point of discussion on the film that they had to figure out a way to have Bob Balaban look less like Richard Dreyfuss. That's why he has the big beard and the glasses.
That's wild. Anyway, yes.
Point being, everybody looked the same in the 70s. So this dude was going around LA pretending to be Steven Spielberg, getting people to buy him dinner or you know, write off his check for dinner, and generally giving the director a bad name. So Spielberg got really upset and took out an ad in the Hollywood Reporter saying, "To the gullible and defenseless, the man walking the streets of Los Angeles is not Steven Spielberg. Steven Spielberg is in Alabama, making Close Encounters of the Third Kind. At least do not allow this sad fraud to make you pay for dinner. This year, Steven Spielberg can afford a meal."
Oh, wow. So there you go. Hey, flaunting your old privilege there, Stevie. But but also, what's the thinking behind that? So this is an ad in the Hollywood Reporter?
Hollywood Reporter, yeah.
And he's expecting everyone in Hollywood who works in a restaurant to see this somehow?
I'm assuming so. Okay. I mean, probably they do, in fairness. Like, everybody working in a restaurant in LA, as I understand it, is an actor trying to get into the business. So presumably does read the Hollywood Reporter daily. So
Did they get the guy?
The records on that are silent.
Yeah, seems to me like, you know, old Stevie S was covering his tracks.
What, flying back to LA to get a free dinner and then flying back to the set? Well, yeah, it's convincing.
Yeah, it is impossible to approve or disprove. So therefore, I think I'm safe legally. on that one. Anyway, let's move on quickly. God, imagine if I got sued by Steven Spielberg. That'd be amazing. I mean, what a privilege that would be.
Again, as your lawyer, that should not be your aim. You know, just saying, I'm
not
just
an aim.
That
you could probably make it happen without too much effort. So.
More of a happy accident more than anything else.
Again, similarly, not that happy. You know, he's got very, very good lawyers.
Yeah. How do you plead? Guilty, but your honor, it's just a privilege to be here. Do you think anyone's ever called Steven Spielberg Stevie, by the way? I think that's massively disrespectful, so don't do it.
Do you?
Yeah.
Well, isn't it? Didn't he call John Williams Johnny? So maybe John Williams in turn is allowed to call him Stevie.
Oh, Johnny and Stevie. You just put me in mind of Schitt's Creek. I have 4 episodes to go, folks.
It's so good.
4 episodes to go. Please, no spoilers. I don't know what's happening. I don't know what happens. I haven't looked up anything that you know. I've seen one spoiler tweet on one spoiler picture on Twitter. But anyway, Jimbo.
Christopher.
You have the floor. How long do we set aside for this? Beth, Helen, well, do you want to go walk away?
Yeah, just go and make a coffee.
Have a
sit
down. Yeah. Go warm a cockles.
Maybe,
yeah.
Maybe a 4-hour roast. Just go grab lunch.
Anyway, fine. I'll still be talking when you get back.
Yes.
Okay, look, let's be honest. I'm far too lazy to have come up with a new fact for this week. And why would one not recycle when one had the opportunity? Recognition of the fact that we watched The Map of Tiny Perfect Things last week, which is a film heavily inspired by Groundhog Day. I have prepared, or I did prepare last week, a series of facts about that very film that I didn't get to share. You're a twat and you cancelled the facts. So you're going to get them this week instead, because I'm fucked if I'm coming up with new ones. So I should also point out, I did not get these facts from Nick DeSemin's best-selling book, Wild and Crazy Guys, but rather ferreted them out over the course of at least 5 minutes on the Googles. Okay. Ready?
Wow, five minutes.
Okay, so firstly, as you may know, this is warm-up.
Sorry.
Yes.
Facts?
Oh, plural? Yes.
Yes. One fact.
It is a gestalt fact. They all come together to form a larger whole, a bit like Devastator in Transformers.
Why is this happening?
Firstly, as you will probably know, Bill Murray was not the first choice for Phil Connors. In fact, both Tom Hanks and Michael Keaton were offered the lead in that film. Hanks refused, apparently because he didn't think his nice guy image would kind of work with that character. And Michael Keaton apparently didn't understand the script and went on record saying so. So fair play. But apparently when Danny Rubin wrote the screenplay, the person he had in mind for Phil was actually Kevin Kline. So I don't know what happened there. Another fact is the amount of time Phil Connors spends in Punxsutawney Purgatory is kind of a contested one. So in the original script, anyone like to guess how long he spends in the loop?
10,000 years.
10,000 years is the correct answer.
The
correct answer is 10,000 years. Okay. Harold Ramis, though. May he rest in peace. Before his die, did say that he reckons it was 30 to 40 years in his film because he thinks 10,000 is ridiculous. Apparently, Phil was reading one page of one book in the Punxsutawney Library every single day, and that's how he was keeping track of the passage of time. So there you go. Now, the puddle that Phil steps in, yes, the doozy, as it were, that still exists. They filmed Groundhog Day in Woodstock, Illinois, and there is still where they had to dig out some bricks to make that puzzle. And there is a plaque there that simply reads, Bill Murray stepped here. But none of those things are my fact, of course, because my fact concerns the real star of the film.
You could just skip to the actual fact. You don't have to do these shitty-ass sub-facts.
It's an amuse-bouche, a great meal,
not,
as you all know, Chris.
It's not an
amuse-bouche
because it's not amusing. My bouche is not amused.
The entree, of course, revolves around the true star of the film, which is Punxsutawney Phil, who is a real-life figure and has been, and this is absolutely true, predicting the weather in Punxsutawney since 1886. This...
Not the same groundhog.
Despite the fact that the average life expectancy of a groundhog is roughly 6 years. Yeah. However... According to Punxsutawney lore, Phil has been kept sprightly by the regular infusion of groundhog punch and something they call the elixir of life, which I think is the plot of one of the DC movies. Anyway, this is administered each year on the annual groundhog picnic in the autumn. And Phil, who is obviously very long-lived for a groundhog, is so famous that he was once flown to New York and appeared on Oprah back in 1995.
Didn't Oprah shoot in Chicago? I thought Oprah shot in Chicago.
Wherever Oprah shoots. He was flown wherever Oprah shoots. Okay, stop upending my fact. But Phil, and he is Phil, only got his name in 1961. And it is believed he was actually named after our very own Duke of Edinburgh. Did you know that?
Do you know who else was named after Duke of Edinburgh?
Go on.
The prince in Sleeping Beauty.
Ooh.
I mean, that's less good than the groundhog, I'm saying.
I mean, I'm just saying, it was going right at the time.
Do you know where Groundhog Day comes from? Do you know where it actually originates?
Puxtawny?
No, but like it's a Celtic thing. It's a Germanic Celtic crossover type thing it was something to do with if a hibernating animal casts a shadow on February the 2nd, then the pagan holiday of Imbolc would last another 6 weeks. And if no shadow is seen, legend says, spring will come early. So, and in Germany, it evolved into the myth and there you go. And that's why in Candlemas, there's a whole hedgehog shadow thing. It's all related to that as well. And German immigrants, of course, came to Pennsylvania, and that is how Groundhog Day arrived.
That was a bit of a filibuster, wasn't it?
It did feel like it lasted
2 hours. Groundhog Day routinely got very few people. It now gets about 20,000 people turn up to Punxsutawney each year for Groundhog Day. And PETA have objected to the whole event because they say it puts undue stress on Phil. And they've suggested replacing Phil, and this is absolutely true, with some kind of hybrid robotic groundhog, as it would be more humane.
Do you know that? Do you know that Bill Murray
Phil's
went
also
to
been
see...
sued on three Good occasions Lord. For being wrong? There's another fact for you.
Do you know that Bill Murray went to see the Groundhog Day musical two nights in a row?
Oh, did that's he? Lovely.
Isn't that lovely?
Yeah. I like that a lot.
I mean, my God. Here's where I am. I'm on the brink of just throwing myself into the Thames, but also taking Jimbo with me. It's not a court in the land we can convict. Anywho, here's my dilemma. I don't want to reward James's behaviour in coming up with multiple facts when really only one fact would do, and filibustering for what seemed like 10,000 years in a segment that I wanted to be fairly tight. On the other hand, he did pronounce Imbolc. And I think that alone means that he should win this week's three fact structure.
Thank you. Oh, can I?
My dilemma. I haven't given you the point yet. I think that's my dilemma.
Oh, right. Okay. So I haven't officially won yet. Fine.
Anyway, so someone called quo_Fatimus on Twitter sent in a DM to me saying that she has been keeping track of the three fact structure scores, which is good because I stopped after 3 weeks. And James's victory this week means he's level in points with Helen.
Yes!
Ooh,
17 really? Points apiece.
I thought he was ahead already, to be perfectly
hang on,
honest.
17. How?
We've been doing this way too long.
How have there been that many facts?
The fourth chair has got 14 points. And don't forget, sometimes I award multiple points in a week. But we've been doing it since podcast 407. Jeez. And this is podcast 453. God. And we've
this
skipped a couple of weeks here and there.
I now feel like I'm in Groundhog Day.
We're coming up almost to the first anniversary, 1 year anniversary of the beloved three fact structure. So happy birthday to this segment. And it's happy birthday to this segment. It is the listener question segment, which has been going since, week three, week two, something like that, all way back in the day. When we had one listener and he would just send in stuff. And the question this week comes from @AndyParks on Twitter. And he asks, after the Mars coverage this week, what's the best spaceship landing in movies? So if you don't know what's happened, basically NASA landed a robot spaceship called Perseverance on
Percy.
The... Percy. What's
We're
it called?
Percy.
Oh, Percy.
It is Perseverance. No, it's Perseverance.
It's Perseverance,
Percy,
yeah. Perseverance on the surface of Mars and found one of Matt Damon's shit potatoes. So that's that's nice. Well done, then.
Did you hear the signal that came back from Mars? It just sounded a lot like...
Let's not do the entire segment in Martian talk.
No, I want to watch Mars Attacks.
Love that film. Love that film. So and good. I love the way those spaceships land.
The Mars Attacks DVD has a Martian subtitle track. So it's
that's
just
amazing.
Yes.
On a slightly different note, did anyone see the thing on Twitter this week that somebody posted extracts from Brian Blessed's a Flash Gordon commentary? It's unbelievably great. In fact, no, it's believably great because it is exactly what you think Brian Blessed would say on a film commentary. It's amazing. Yeah, super good. Anyway.
Yes, spaceship landings.
The mothership.
Work.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind again. Oh, I watched it again this week, but I'm genuinely like it's an incredible, incredible scene. Nobody's ever done the like of it. It's amazing.
I take issue with that, Helen. It is no the Enterprise D crash landing in Star Trek Generations now.
That's not okay because they crash land the Enterprise D, which is like the nicest one, and they crashed it, and I was not okay with that, and I'm still not okay with that, and I still haven't forgiven them. So
but, I mean, they did replace the Galaxy Class D with a Sovereign Class E, Helen,
I never
which
liked
in
the
some ways, you know, did come with quantum torpedoes and ablative armor, which was a significant upgrade.
It's okay. I'm versed in this. Just sort of
Beth has done the Pilot TV podcast with me enough times to be immune to this shit.
No one's immune to this shit.
Take faith in the fact James ties himself out eventually.
He's like a toddler. Just let him run around. You know. Give him a juice box when he gets tired.
It does happen. I've seen it happen.
This is why he never speaks during the review section. He's just having a little nap.
I have to have a little lie down. That's just getting revenge for the fact that I made her watch an episode of the Battlestar Galactica remake for Pilot once and she didn't enjoy it.
Why?
It's not I didn't enjoy it as such. I just didn't adopt it as my own personal religion. So it was...
why wouldn't you?
The same thing.
So say we all, Beth. So say we all.
No, don't you. I'm all right with it being James that I let down. I can't let you down, so... Force Awakens. I love the crash landing of the Millennium Falcon in Force Awakens. I'm just charging through and cutting up this discourse right now.
Force Awakens. Crash landing of
the... Where does it land?
It lands on Starkiller Base.
But they sort of crash land it really skillfully, and it ends just on the cusp of the mountain, and a few kind of balls of snow fall down, but not enough. And I thought that was very cool.
Okay, all right.
Space Jam in the baseball pitch. Uh-huh. That's a great one.
Yeah.
If you can remember that. Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Jordan.
Oh, yeah. Another ship that lands on a baseball pitch is in The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is what inspired my Squadcast name this week. The original The Day the Earth Stood Still, the Robert Wise, The Day the Earth Stood Still, not the Scott Derrickson one, which is not that good. The spaceship comes in hovering and it's really good scenes, shots of people in Washington. It lands in Washington and people looking up at the spaceship going, oh, what is this spaceship? And then it kind of hovers and it lands on a baseball mound. And it's like, ooh, what's more American than a baseball? Subtext, political satire and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, but that's really good. I like that. I also like the way the Millennium Falcon lands generally, it's just a cool bit of reverse thrusting going on.
Yeah, I seem to remember the Viper's landing in Battlestar actually being pretty cool. I don't know if it counts as landing because it's technically, you know, on a ship.
Hello, but... I think you find this is a film podcast and that should be reserved for the Pilot TV podcast. Oh my God. So I'm disqualifying that.
While we're on the subject. Okay, then say something that isn't a TV show, James. Come on.
All of mine are crash related, unfortunately.
Why?
I don't know what that says about me. But anyway, so I would say Serenity in Serenity. I am a leaf on the wind.
Oh, that's not the best. That's the worst.
The APC and Aliens, that's a hell of a crash sequence. I particularly like the way it's done, where it's playing out on a screen and they're just diving around rocks on the soundstage in front of it.
Which is very ahead of its time, isn't it?
Yeah. The effects in that film, which I watched again last week, as I have a tendency to do, fucking are astonishing and stand up really, really well. The crash in Pitch Black is quite a stormer.
That's really good. Yeah.
Big fan of that. I'm also a big fan of our Pitch Black spoiler special podcast, which we recorded last year, which you can get now at the bargain price of $2.99 a month. Just
what's
a spoiler special podcast there.
Synergy.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, wow. Brand synergy, Chris. Plug the spoiler special podcast at their new lower bargain price.
Yeah, especially with like everyone putting their prices up or creating brand new streaming services that no one's going to watch.
That's right.
Which we may talk about later on. But we're going down in price.
Yeah, don't get
Come
Paramount
on
Plus. Get our spoiler special podcast.
Yeah, synergy. Wow. Mm. Yeah. But I also those are good sequences. I like that. A nice bit of crashing's good. And I'm also going to stretch this to accept ships that don't land technically.
Okay.
Because there's something great about a giant city-sized flying saucer coming in and just kind of hovering over a city.
Independence Day. Yeah.
I mean,
when
that
it comes out
thought
of the cloud of the sort of vapor, that's fun.
That's super cool.
The great Matt Solerseitz, who's a fantastic film critic, was talking on Twitter the other day about how the first 45 minutes of that movie are perfect. And I'm inclined to agree with him.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's pretty much downhill from the from the minute that they blow the shit out of the world. But, you know, still enjoyable. I still really, really like Independence Day. But that first 45 minutes is just incredible. Yeah. And the awe-inspiring nature of the ships, which are 15 miles wide, something like that. It's just incredible. And I don't think we spent long enough, frankly, on Close Encounters. That's what a sequence, Helen.
Isn't it incredible? And it's the way that the ship just, like, turns upside down as it comes in as well. You're just like, it just to give you a chance to like really take in how fucking incredibly beautiful and alien and enormous the thing is. And it's the way it comes over Devil's Peak and just dwarfs it beneath it. You're just like, holy shit, just got notes. Real.
Oh my God, yeah. And just the sheer size of the whole thing. And those notes, of course.
Wow. You probably should have started a bit higher. Actually,
that's usually my problem. Okay, here we go. I'll start again. Higher.
No, it doesn't work.
Oh yeah, I should drop that note up. Okay. Inspiring stuff, don't you think?
Just as John Williams intended.
Exactly that. That's Williams reborn right there.
I was angry initially about paying £7 for this kazoo, but it's actually the best £7 I've ever spent. It's really tremendous. You can punctuate any conversation with a bit of kazoo. But yeah, that's, I love that. Good. I also love the spaceships we don't see landing at the beginning of John Carpenter's The Thing. Where we see...
Hang on. Do we think we might have strayed slightly out of the bounds of the question at this point?
No, because
we're
answering landing.
The direct opposite.
It's landing. No, because it's crashing. We just don't see it crashing. And also we see the Predator ship coming, being sent to Earth at the beginning of Predator as well. And I've always wondered if they needed to show that.
I know. That's one of the things where So my issue with the Alien Special Edition is that they introduce the scene where they discover the derelict ahead of the Marines arriving on LV-426. And I think you got the same problem in Predator there. It takes a lot of the drama away when you kind of know for 100% sure what's going to happen. Mm. Like, you know there's going to be an alien. It's much better if there's something out there hunting us and it ain't no man. You know, you don't know what it is. That's where you want to be.
On the edge. I mean, that's got me thinking about circular ships and not about Prometheus, but about the crash in Infinity War. The crash landing there is kind of fun, silly, but fun.
Yeah. And we are duty bound.
Of course.
To talk about the MCU at some point. So, yes, thank you for introducing that, Helen. Otherwise, we would have been electrocuted. I think that's what... I must talk about the MCU. But also when those dickheads, Ebony Maw and the big fella, they come to Earth at the beginning of the movie, don't they? And it lands. You can see it land in New York. That's pretty cool. Although
it doesn't
technically
land. No, because it beams them down,
doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It does not land.
Yeah.
You know what does land? The Enterprise in Star Trek Into Darkness, under the sea.
No, I was going to say
under the sea.
I was going to go with Voyage Home. You lost me when you said Into Darkness.
Well, see, that's the Bounty, not the Enterprise. But yes, so they have the Klingon Bird of Prey, and I love the fact that they just hide it in a park and just leave it there cloaked, which is nice.
Invisible, like the lady who wants to make Scripps happy.
Indeed. Yeah. Hey, callback.
Invisible, silent, and deadly. She's come to town with a few days to kill.
Only in the hottest years she comes.
This year.
She uses the jungle. When the big man was killed, they must have wounded her. Her blood was on the leaves.
Oh my God.
If it bleeds, we can kill it.
Yes, the Predator musical. It all comes back to the Predator musical.
See, what would she have done with Predator? She would have gone, this isn't happy enough. The Predator and Dutch don't become best friends at the end of the script. They need to dance and have a musical number.
But that's why you have the bit at the end where it's, you have been watching Predator. And you see all the cast like winking at the camera.
She's like,
there we go. That's a bit of buoyancy to end the movie. Let's have Shane Black reading a comic.
Oh dear, yes indeed. Any more before we wrap up this frankly farcical section? Helen's looking faintly horrified.
I just saw a picture of Kenneth Branagh as Boris Johnson. And
oh, really?
God, ooh. Really? Okay.
Hang on.
I now must see this.
It's not good, guys. It's
my eyes.
That's horrible.
Pass me the mind bleach.
No, absolutely not. No, I refuse.
Oh.
Okay. The spaceships. I'm just going to have to think about the mothership now until I calm down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about docking? What about spaceships docking?
Well, Interstellar
when it goes wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think... that's a good one. I think it's got to be one of the like Enterprises sailing into space dock or out of space dock. Those are my favourite bits.
Oh, the really tedious moment in Star Trek:
you
The
mean
Motion
the
Picture.
Jupiter Planitia Shipyards, Helen.
No, I mean space dock. Shut up. I might mean the Jupiter Planitia space docks as well. Anyway, I was actually thinking of the start of Star Trek 2009 with that one, with the attempt to get out without scraping the paintwork, basically, which is quite cute.
Oh.
Oh.
2001. Yeah. There's a lot of docking in that. There's a lot of docking in that.
No, this sounds wrong.
Yeah. The Event Horizon.
Can we not talk about space docking on this podcast? Yeah. I think it's just, you know, inappropriate.
I thought that joke had died too.
No. Good thing about space docking is you can just freeze it and reuse it. So it's all good. It's all good. Right. Well, I was going to try and mention 2001, but I think this is coming to an end. I think this is it. This is it now. If you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast, you can get in touch with us via one method and one method only. Just space talk with me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Hewitt. You can slide into my DMs or you can just reply to one of my tweets. Any of my tweets, doesn't really matter. Just pick one of the funny ones. Wait, that doesn't narrow it down. They're all funny. Or you can reply to one of my panicked shoutouts every now and again. Right, time now for our first guest this week, and Coming to America, the much-anticipated sequel to Coming to America. I mean, they haven't thought this through.
It's Coming to America, like,
I know,
step
but it's
up
hard
to the streets.
I know, but it's hard to kind of get that across.
You have to say Coming to America.
Yeah, you have to say that. Like, too fast. Too furious.
Coming to America, which is a sequel to Coming to America, is out next week. It is out on Amazon Prime Video. What a time to be alive. And the gang's all back, pretty much. You know, so Eddie Murphy's back, Arsenio Hall's back, James Earl Jones is back, Shari Headley's back. But there are some new faces in this one, and one of the new faces is... an old face, we've seen him before. It is Wesley Snipes. Yes, indeed. Blade himself, the Daywalker himself. He is in this movie, reuniting with Craig Brewer, who was his director on Dolomite Is My Name. And I caught up with Wesley via Zoom, but the sound's actually pretty good, I think, a couple of weeks ago. And I just hung on for grim life, quite frankly. The man is a delight. This was a real pleasure. Hope you guys enjoyed as much as I did. Here's me talking to Wesley Snipes. Enjoy. Hello, Wesley.
Hey, Chris Hewitt. What's happening, man?
I'm good, sir. How are you?
I do know what's happening. It's Coming to America, too. That's what's happening, man. So it's a silly question. The fact that I asked it in the first place. How silly of me.
I think my work here is done, Wesley. Thanks very much. We're all good. Just in case I forgot the name of the film.
Yeah.
we're all good. How the devil are you, sir?
Yeah, man, I'm good. I'm in a good space. Energy's good.
Mm-hmm.
I'm enjoying this ride with, having one of my bucket lists checked off. opportunity to work with Eddie and Arsenio, and being, for me, which was the most iconic movies of my post-college graduation acting school experience.
Yes. It's a hell of a thing. It's a hell of a thing. How many things do you have on your bucket list, by the way?
Oh, I got a few.
Uh-huh. What's
definitely
left?
Definitely a couple of them. I hope we can do that one day. I would like to do, and I promise to do, a roller coaster tour. A tour of some of the best and the greatest roller coasters in the world. I want to do this with my sons and daughter. I don't think my daughter is going to do it, but my sons definitely will. These action boys like their dad. They're like, yeah, let's go. So that's on the back of the bucket list. I would say another thing on the bucket list is to finally work with Meryl Streep. Man, I came close. I was producing a film in the 80s. That was a motorcycle movie. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be really cool to have Meryl Streep play like a motorcycle chick.
Yeah.
You know, so I called her up and we talked about it, but the movie never materialized. And no, we've never seen her as a motorcycle chick, as far as I recall.
No, she could do most things, I would say, but motorcycle
she's
chick.
She's an alien. Yeah, she's an alien. Yeah, she's by far, male or female, the top actress in my book, actor.
Yeah.
In America, by far.
She's amazing. She's absolutely amazing. Phenomenal. Well, phenomenal. Wesley, I hope that both these things are ticked off your bucket list at some point. Even if you get them mixed up and you take Meryl Streep on a roller coaster tour, I'd be okay with that.
I'm with that. I'm with that. I'd buy that ticket.
I absolutely would. Honestly, if I could be an onlooker, an innocent bystander watching Wesley Snipes and Meryl Streep ride roller coasters, I'd die a happy man. I really would. But this particular thing that you've ticked off your bucket list, which is finally working with Eddie Murphy, you look like you are having the best time in this movie.
Yeah, man. Absolutely. Absolutely. A great creative good time, mm-hmm. an opportunity to be in an ensemble. I like ensemble work. I grew up around ensemble work. I cut my teeth on my skills, early skills, being an ensemble performer. Even as a street dancer, you know, you rocking with your crew. So yeah. I like that. And the action movies kind of take you away from that, yeah. unless you have your action team, your team.
Yeah.
But from the, you know, on-camera acting side of it, ensemble is the best. That's so much fun. So great to do. Great to finally have that opportunity and, you know, try to bring my best work or at least, you know, respect the iconic film and its status in the world, mm-hmm. respect the other actors and respect Eddie and the visionaries.
Yes.
Who brought us back to this, you know, 30 years later.
Absolutely. So obviously you and Eddie and Craig had worked together on Dolomite Is My Name. At what point was it during the making of that movie, maybe in between takes, Craig or Eddie sidles up to you and goes, "Hey man, I'm thinking of doing Coming to America. You interested?" Or was it more complicated than that?
I wish, yes. I wish. I want to tell this story. Yes. No. No. Actually, I was the last chick at the bar, you know, waiting to see if somebody was going to invite me to the after party. And finally, Craig, finally, literally at a screening of Dolomite Is My Name, finally, after this, and this is after post-production
right.
on the film.
Right.
And everybody, almost everybody else knows that there's a Coming to America coming. And I'm hearing it. Nobody's talking to me. So I waited by the door until Craig was ready to leave. You know, and I stood there very, very sumptuously waiting for him. And sure enough, it worked. I blinked, I batted my eyes, and I said, "Hi, Craig." And he's like, "I got to talk to you, man. I want you to be in the movie." I was like, "Oh, really? Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah." "Yes, I've been hearing about that. Well, that's wonderful to think of me."
And then what did he say? How did he lay out the part of Easy for you?
Well, he told me he wanted me to be the bad guy to go up against, you know, Akeem. And I thought, oh, that's going to be fun. Now I get to play, you know, scenes with Eddie in a real comedy, in a real comedy.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, you know, I don't want to do your typical or some of the characterizations you've seen with African despots, you know, the dramatic side of it. Forrest Whitaker did a wonderful Idi Amin.
Yeah.
Idris Elba did a wonderful Beast of No Nations. I'm like, okay, I think that maybe, you know, my General Easy, he might like to dance, you know, he might like to party. He might like to party. None of those guys look like they like to party. General Easy is like to party, man, you know. I mean, guns and fun.
Easy by name, easy by nature, right?
Yeah, you can't have fun without guns.
That's what they told me.
It's natural. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I wanted to bring all of those kind of energies to it. You know, the guys who were studying abroad and then figured, you know, they encounter everybody. And especially the ones who have the blessing of coming to Hollywood.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then, of course, they brush up against Jay-Z or they brush up against Beyonce. By the time they get back to Lagos, they are the best friends, you know? You say, oh, yeah, they wanted me to stay. But I told Beyonce, no, I can't do that. I'm not the performer. You're the performer. And they tell this to everybody. You be like, yo, man, did you really meet Beyonce? But yeah, I wanted to bring that. I know that my friends who are like this, they're going to be laughing their ass off. Because they're going to recognize it, you know. Why are you doing me? Why are you doing me? If they wanted me, they should have called me.
Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, right?
I love them. I love them, definitely.
So, but Wesley, was there a sense of, because I know, and you've referred to this in previous interviews and on your Twitter feed as well, that, you know, you auditioned for Coming to America all those years ago, and you got really, really close. So was there a sense of unfinished business?
I caught the L, B. I caught a straight L. L7. I caught a straight L.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was traumatized by that. I was devastated. Went in my bathroom and I was like weeping.
Oh, man. Well, was it three callbacks you had for that role?
At least three.
Right. So, yes. So as an actor, you get three callbacks. You must begin to think, that's it. It's in the bag.
Oh, and, you know, I'm looking at Eddie and I'm looking, oh, well, I look like Eddie. Of course, I want to be, you know, I'm the best choice in out of all of these guys. You know, Eric LaSalle, and I think Mario Van Peebles was the other guy. I mean, clearly, it couldn't be Mario, a good-looking guy like him. Got to be more like a guy like me. Clearly, that's the character. Mario Van Peebles, he's a model. He can't be that guy. He's too good-looking. Come on. They didn't see things my way, unfortunately.
Yeah, this is true. But everything happens for a reason, right? So
everything happens for a reason. Yes, sir.
You could come into America. You might not be in Coming to America because this movie, Eric LaSalle, is conspicuous by his absence.
Yeah. Well, I won't say what happened to him. Him and Jimmy Hoffa, you know, things happen. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, I hear his character is the subject of The Irishman 2. It's a 3-hour movie about how he disappears.
Right. Exactly. What happened to him?
It's a very, very
what
dark tale.
What happened to Daryl? What happened to Daryl? I don't know. You know, things happen.
Robert De Niro happened to him. That's what happened to him.
That's right. Well, you know, General Easy has a lot of friends.
Yep. Some of them are in the gangster persuasion.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, Robert. Yeah, you know, it was General Easy who told Robert to put the D in front of De Niro because he was Robert Nero. And I told him, I said, well, that's not a good look, you know. Nero wasn't a good guy. I think you should put the D.
Yeah.
D for dynamic.
Yeah.
D for yeah. And he said, oh yeah. He said, yeah. You can keep it. No commission.
Robert De Niro, Robert Money, De Niro. That's what I'm thinking of. That's what you know.
That's what Gino Easy thinking. Oh, you can be a general, you can be a citizen of Lake Victoria, no problem. You can be a citizen.
I want 25% up front, Wesley. I'm not going to, you know, mess around. 25%
like
up front.
Oh, like a colonizer again. See, all these colonizers, they don't change.
but you're back on, you're on the set of Coming to America. Daryl, yeah. Eric LaSalle, he's been bumped off by Robert De Niro. There you are with...
So we're here. So we don't know.
We don't know. You're on the set with Eddie... You're improvising with Eddie? Is that something that happens on this?
A little bit. Yes.
A little bit.
Because Eddie also, he'll do it in words, but he'll do it in facial expressions. And, you know, that's I love that. You know, give me the assist. Throw me a ball or, you know, set me up and then I can respond. Or I can come back with an assist. I know it's going to be a, you know, a layup dunk or, you know, something like that. And I'm like, boom. just by watching the facial expressions or listening to the tone, inflection, the variation there, yeah. the read of the line, and, you know, I can flip with it. Yeah. And he's excellent at it, you know.
That's amazing.
That's why he's Eddie.
And do you guys get together before the cameras roll and go, okay, I'm thinking of doing this, just roll with it, or is it literally all in the moment? No, okay.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
No. To give him an opportunity to be prepared? Absolutely not.
That's how I hear Meryl Streep works, Wesley. So if you're going to do that,
oh,
then...
Oh, she wants to know ahead of time?
She needs to know.
Maybe that's why I've never worked with her. I don't know how to play by the rules.
But this is it. This is it. Absolutely.
No. If you're in a scene with me, you better be ready.
You know what?
I'm definitely listening to you.
I'm getting
you.
A sense of that in this interview, that you need to be ready to work with Wesley
Snipes.
I'm
going to listen to you. I'm not nowhere else. When I'm in the scene with you, I'm in the scene with you.
I am focused. Entirely focused.
So...
I've got to let you go in a second, but Wesley, I am a huge fan of Blade. And can I just take a second to compliment you on your delivery of what I believe is the greatest line in the history of motion pictures? I think you know what it is. Some motherfuckers are always trying to ice skate uphill.
Wonderful. Yeah. A line that came up over... cream cheese chicken or grilled chicken in a wonderful French Louisiana cream cheese sauce. And we were all sitting at my table at the dining table, uh-huh. going through the script and talking about, you know, the characters, and it just came out and we kept it. Yeah.
There were no alts.
I didn't know how prophetic it was and how true it was. I mean, it was like, you know, it was a flipping, I mean, you know, just a flipped off comment. But man, how true that has proven to be.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have any tattoos, but if I did, I'd get a tattoo on my forehead because, you know, that's very prophetic. You've described the state of the world there, my friend.
Yeah. And they're still doing it, man. That's crazy. It's like, haven't you heard?
Indeed. Well, it's been a pleasure, man. Some motherfuckers always trying to ice skate uphill, and some motherfuckers always trying to, you know, go roller coaster riding with Meryl Streep. Wesley, I wish you all the best with that, man.
All the best. Same to you, brother.
It's been a pleasure. Peace. Thank you.
Salute.
All right, so that was Wesley Snipes. What a delight he was. And we will be talking about Coming to America on next week's show. Sorry, Coming to America on next week's show. Right, time now to delve deep into the week's movie news. And I think there's only really one place to start. And that is with news that Spider-Man 3 is no longer called Spider-Man 3. Not that it ever was. It is now called
Spider-Man
after much
Homes
chicanery,
Under the Hammer.
Yes, Spider-Man Homes Under the Hammer. No, it's called Spider-Man No Way Home after an amusing little bit of kerfuffle the other day where Tom Holland and Zendaya and Jacob Batalon all released different titles for the movie.
Oh, the fun jokesters. We had.
I'm genuine. I think it's brilliant and I think more people should do it. I love it. I absolutely loved it. So they suggested Spider-Man Phone Home, Spider-Man Home Wrecker, and Spider-Man Home Slice. And I just absolutely love that.
Oh, Home Slice. Oh, how I miss that place.
Oh, that pizza.
Oh, it's a place in London, folks. If London ever opens again, and, you know, this week the news does seem to be encouraging that we're heading back in that direction, and that cinemas might be opening again. Oh my god!
Cinemas aim to be opening in May. That is pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, maybe we should let with that. Actually,
it's almost like that was the big news. The cinema's coming back, and we can go back to the cinema.
Well, I've been bearing the lead my entire career. Why break the habit of a lifetime now? So there's a great place in London. It is near Neil Street, which is where the Empire offices used to be.
It's in Neil's Yard.
Of Neil's Yard. Yes, in Neil's Yard, which is off Shaftesbury Avenue.
Monmouth Street.
It's called Home Slice. It's really great. They do massive, great, big fucking pizzas. And they do a slice. It was £5 a slice. And you may be thinking to yourself, Chris, that's a lot of money for a slice of pizza.
But
this thing is the size of a small truck. So, yeah. And it's really, really nice and well worth it. Yeah.
You know, they do home delivery. You can get home kits.
Can you?
like maybe where you live, you know, in fancy London, but not where we live in unfancy London. So
Helen, I don't have a television, so please do see me some sort of grand idea of London living.
Yeah. Also, I don't know, I think Greenwich is pretty fancy, don't you?
Oh, I apologize. It's south of the river, and therefore we don't get a lot of the deliveries.
No, this is true. We don't go south of the river at this time of night. It's not the pizza delivery, that's for sure. Anyway, Spider-Man, yes. No Way Home.
No Way Home. That's fine.
I'm happy with that.
Yeah, I can live with it.
I've been thinking a lot about this Spider-Man film because, let's be honest, none of us have anything better to do at the moment. And so I'd thought when all of this, you know, kerfuffle around, you know, Jamie Foxx and everything was announced that initially I had a very negative reaction to it. And then mm-hmm. I warmed to it as the way mm-hmm. they were going to open the multiverse to the MCU. And now I've kind of reversed course on it, where I'm not saying it's bad, but my worry is that this is less about introducing the multiverse to the MCU and more about introducing the Sony back catalogue to Spider-Man. And I feel that the gateway to the multiverse from the MCU will come via Doctor Strange. And I feel like this is very much going to be more of a serving the broader future adventures within the Sonyverse and less about the MCU. And that gives me pause.
I think that's possibly right. And I wonder if No Way Home reflects the fact that he might end up in a different reality that is more divorced from the MCU films. And obviously there can still be crossover because somebody can reopen the multiverse. Blah, blah, blah. But it does feel like this might be a bit of a way to step away from the MCU.
And into such august company as Venom and Morbius, the living vampire.
Which might be great. We haven't seen it yet.
Yes, which will almost certainly be a five-star film.
It could be good. I don't know. I think the fact that this is going to come out before Doctor Strange, I think this is going to be the
Christmas. It's coming out this Christmas.
Christmas.
Okay, could we just ask a question here? How many MCU films do we think we're going to see this year? Because if I do a quick little bit of finger maths, it feels like there are potentially quite a few of them.
Well, it's, you know, Black Widow and Eternals and Spider-Man.
Oh, Shang-Chi is meant to be this year as well, isn't it?
Are we going to see four MCU movies in 6 months?
No, I think Shang-Chi might drop back if Eternals and Black Widow are both this year.
But doesn't it depend on, you know, because there's going to be some logjam in terms of their mythology, isn't it?
With you this week? You're finger mathing, you're space talking, now you're log jamming?
I know, I'm sorry.
This is not okay.
A long pandemic. I'm just saying, you know, they're going to have this sort of traffic jam of story. And at some point, they're running all these TV shows. At some point, they're going to say, no, we've got to get Shang-Chi out there or no one's going to understand this other thing here. So are they just going to sort of backload, steady, a load of these MCU films in the second half of this year and, you know, to get it all out there?
Maybe.
And thus making it the greatest 6 months in the history of cinema.
I mean, it is going to be the greatest 6 months in the history of cinema anyway, because we're also deprived.
Dune is coming out, Helen, that's right.
Because Dune is coming out and because we're all so deprived and just desperate to be back in the cinema. Oh, my God.
I'll watch fucking anything at the moment, honestly.
Mean, seriously, can you imagine just the chairs and the people and the big screen that isn't your TV? Oh.
I think they're good at rolling with the punches, Jimbo. I think they'll be aware of it. The fact that Spider-Man was meant to come out after Doctor Strange, it's now coming out before Doctor Strange. I think, you know, they'll have made story adjustments so that they'll be able to flow effortlessly into each other.
So you think, like, the villain at the end of WandaVision will be Morbius?
Oh, God, I hope not.
Oh, God, no.
Oh, no, please, no. But then that might mean Blade. Blade might have to come out of nowhere to fight Morbius, the living vampire.
Yeah, there's something we should talk about that on the spoiler special tomorrow. But anyway, not to get hung up on WandaVision again.
No, let's not do that.
Yeah. God forbid.
WandaVision spoiler specials drop every Monday for the bargain price of $2.99 a month.
What's happened to you?
Synergy.
What happened to you?
He's innovating.
Okay. Beth, as someone who has the last name Webb, are you disposed? Are you how do you feel about Spider-Man? Is he friend? Is he foe?
Is he related to you?
Yeah, it's Beth Webslinger is the full name. I do have to say, I am becoming more and more invested, perhaps as someone who has been emotionally invested at best with the MCU. I am becoming more and more gripped, I think, and a lot of that is due to WandaVision and the new phase of Spider-Man films. And I think as someone who is kind of condensing it as like a singular film, I'm excited for this because I love the central performers. I love Zendaya. I love Tom Holland. I don't know how much the mythology and the multiverse is going to undo my appreciation of those performers and what they bring to the franchise. So in that respect, I'm excited. I'm expected to be very, very confused. But generally, I'm hanging in there. I have a lot of faith in them, and I have a lot of faith in what they've done with this so far. I think it's been my favourite so far. But yeah.
And the first images they released from the movie this week on their Instagram pages were of those three together, of Peter Parker, and MJ, and Ned, and they're all together, and they seem to be investigating something. It looked, you know, with the color grading on those images, it looked like it was a shot from the National Treasure sequel, or Scooby Doo, which I'm kind of all for. And nothing's been confirmed about any casting. This is all announcements in the trades, but nothing official's been confirmed. So, and Tom Holland the other week said that there is no Tobey Maguire or Andrew Garfield cameo in this movie. Do we believe him? I'm not entirely
sure. Well, that could
be
careful wording that it's not a cameo.
Maybe they just haven't told him.
That would be wisest. There is that joke even in this little announcement video about the film. It's like, why wouldn't they tell me? He's like, are you kidding? Because you leak everything. How does that ever happen?
He does. He's a spoiler machine. He really is. He'd love our spoiler specials. Just £2.99 or £32.99 a year. It's not like he can't afford it.
Okay.
Two things broke last week.
Okay.
As the podcast went up, and they're both, I think, warrant investigation or conversation. And one of them is the news that Gareth Evans, our good old pod chum Gareth Evans, the director of the Raid movies, his next movie looks like it's actually happening, which is fantastic. It's called Havoc, and it will star Tom Hardy. So that's a big bit of news. Big old noise for Gareth Evans. I'm very, very happy for him that he's managed to land a big fish, and with it get the funding, I imagine, as well, to put his latest slice of mayhem on the big screen.
Yeah, looking forward to that, absolutely.
You know what else I'm looking forward to, though?
What's that?
Edgar Wright's new film, which is going to be...
Which one, though?
exactly. But Edgar Wright is doing a new adaptation of The Running Man. Now, obviously, he will not be able to reach the giddy heights of the original Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. That would be far too much to ask. I'm pretty excited about this. I think partly because he's clearly not going to attempt to do what that film did at all, because that film bears absolutely no relation to the Stephen King novel whatsoever, other than the title and the name of the main character. It's written under his Richard Bachman name, but it's very much takes place in the city itself. It's a man on the run. It's more like The Fugitive than it is the actual Running Man movie. But it's a lot bleaker, a lot darker, and it has a really fucking upsetting ending. No spoilers. But this is fun. This is exciting, and I'm here for it.
Yeah, I don't know if that's going to be Edgar's next movie. I would be surprised, quite frankly. He's attached to a whole bunch of stuff at the moment, you know, not least of which is Baby Driver 2. He's attached to adaptations of The Chain and Set My Heart to 5, which is another novel that came out last year. And The Chain is a best-selling thriller by Adrian Mackinder. Mm. And so I think he's attached to about 5 or 6 different things at the moment. So
he's a busy man.
Yeah. Whether this is number one on his docket, I would be surprised, especially since it seemed to be that there's no script.
That didn't stop the last one.
Yes, but that's why we hope this one will be different, James, you know. So
I like Running Man.
Who loves you and who do you love? No, I love it too. It is amazing.
Directed by Starsky or Hutch.
That's right, it was.
It was big indeed. Difference, though, between those two. Speaking of cool British directors with new projects, Alice Lowe has set up her new film Time Stalker, which is to set star Sam Riley and Natasha Dimitru from What We Do in the Shadows, the TV show, and Jacob Anderson. So it's a sort of unrequited love story set across several centuries. So she keeps, I think, getting reincarnated and falling for the same guy, and it keeps not working out every single time. So apparently it will go from 1680s Western Scotland to the apocalyptic 22nd century. So that sounds really, really good fun.
Really excited for that one. That's going to be sick.
Anything else that we want to talk about?
The Killer. By which I'm not about to. I'm not going to spoil any crime thrillers, don't worry. But it is David Fincher's film that has been in some kind of development since, I think, 2000, practically. But it's a film he's been talking about adapting. It's based on the Alexis Nolent graphic novel about a cold-blooded assassin who begins to develop a conscience. Adapted by Andrew Kevin Walker. It has previously been linked to Brad Pitt, and it is now looking like Michael Fassbender is going to take the lead role potentially, and with Netflix, you know, providing the cash. So it could finally happen, and I think it genuinely is about 14 years in development, so it would be very, very good to see that one actually hit screens.
That'll be fun. And also we did talk a few weeks ago, didn't we, about actors who perhaps have lost their way a little bit of late, and not to be unkind, but we did say that, you know, we're all huge fans of Michael Fassbender here, but things perhaps haven't gone swimmingly for him from a career point of view over the last couple of years. And so this would very much get him back on track. A big old David Fincher movie. Yes, please.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. And also continuing from our mothership, Close Encounters chat, Halle Berry is set to star in a film called Mothership for Bridge of Spies' Matt Charman, who's writing and directing. It's another Netflix joint, but it will find her playing a fearless woman whose husband mysteriously vanishes, and then she discovers a strange extraterrestrial object beneath her home. So she and her children set out to find her husband and uncover the truth behind his disappearance, which may involve the CIA. Probably does, because they're always bad uns.
How exciting! Mm. That's exciting. Did anyone see the really sweet moment last week that Andy Muschietti, who is directing the Flash movie,
yes,
he shared on his Instagram, where they've cast a new Supergirl for this movie? It's not going to be Melissa Benoist, who is playing the character on TV. They've cast Sasha Calle. I hope I'm pronouncing her surname right. They've cast her as Supergirl in this movie, which is going to star Ezra Miller. And Andy Muschietti shared the moment that he told her that she had got the gig on a Zoom call. And it's just really, really sweet and lovely. And
did he tear open his shirt and it was written on a t-shirt underneath?
Sadly not. No.
Missed a trick there.
He did. He held up the Supergirl costume and said, you know, can you fly? You're going to need this.
Can you fly, buddy? Yeah.
And I hope she knows that she was going up for Supergirl at that point. Otherwise, it's just been like, well, this is really weird.
This is weird.
Yeah, this is very strange. But yeah, she reacted very, very, very well to it. She is the first Latina actress who will be playing the role of Superman's cousin. So yeah, good stuff.
Yeah.
And that movie will be out next year as well. Maybe another reason why they're fast-tracking Spider-Man, so they can get, so Marvel can get their own multiverse shenanigans out ahead of DC's. All right, so as I mentioned earlier on, there is another streaming service. There is another streaming service, and it's going to be Paramount Plus in the States at least, but don't know whether it's going to even be over here or what it's going to be called.
It's not quite a new streaming service. It's an existing streaming service that's having a rebrand. So it's CBS All Access, which is becoming Paramount Plus.
In the same way that HBO Max is just a rebrand as well.
It's just a facelift. But I guess the big thing here is the release window announcement that came with it. They were talking about things like Quiet Place Part 2. They were talking about things like the new Mission Impossible. And they were saying they were looking at a 45-day window between theatrical and streaming releases, which, I've got to be honest, is not a long time. And that's only for those big tentpole titles. They're looking at 30-day windows for some of the smaller films as well. So that's a quick old hop, skip, and a jump from the multiplayer to your living room if, and this is very important, you live in America.
Yes.
Yeah. And it may be that the cinemas will have something to say about that once they're up and running again. There may be...
Yes, like fuck right off.
Yeah, exactly. Especially if it's later in the year anyway. It's a funny time to be announcing something like that, I think. But
It's just, I guess all of these studios have kind of realigned their business models, haven't they? And they've obviously found ways to monetize these streaming services in a successful way. And they're trying to, I guess, think, how does that then fit with the world in which cinemas can open again? And how can we make all of the fat stacks of the monies?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, there's been this conversation has been going on for a long time, and it's not going to cease to go on just because of the pandemic. The question of windows, the question of streaming, the question of cinema's place in the kind of ecosystem is definitely up for debate and definitely in discussion. But 45 days does seem short 30 yeah. days definitely seems short. And I think there are going to be cinemas that are going to be worried about that. And also, I think there is going to be a point, and we may not have reached it yet, and we may not reach it for some time, but there is going to be a point where this kind of fractured ecosystem where we all subscribe to a million different services, apparently, is maybe going to hit saturation point. And I don't know when that is. But I think
Paramount Plus, I'm guessing.
Maybe. I know, you know, but like, I mean, HBO, you know, they're talking about quite a high price point for that compared to at least the starting prices of things like Netflix and Disney. And therefore, you know, when is enough enough? I mean, Apple already, I think, is, you know, it's got some great shows. You know, we're all huge fans of Ted Lasso, but there aren't a huge number of them. So some of these things are probably going to begin to slip down the charts, as it were, of which things we subscribe to every month.
Yeah, it's really tough. Like once you've set aside your £2.99 a month to pay for the Empire Podcast spoiler specials,
the most important subscription,
then you know you have to make some very very tough choices. But you're right; it's absolutely going to reach saturation point. So you have Netflix, Amazon Prime, you have HBO Max, Hulu in the States as well. Is that still a thing, or is that part of Disney now?
Kind of Disney Plus.
Yeah, Hulu's still a thing in the States. Over here, it's Star, which is rolled into Disney Plus.
But in terms of the streaming wars, because you know, is there going to be a Sony one? What happens to things like Lionsgate and Studio Canal as well? How do they work? There's Sky as well over here also, which is a big thing. But the Paramount one, I mean, the fact that you'll be able to see Mission Impossible 7 and 8 and Quiet Place 2 and things like that, that's all very, very well and good. But their list of shows that they have announced doesn't strike me as must-see, I have to say. So they've gone through their back catalogue, picked out a whole load of, here, get ready, Martin Scorsese, there's going to be some really sexy words coming your way. They picked out some nice, ripe IP to make lovely content from, and they've announced shows based on Fatal Attraction, The Italian Job, Love Story, for the love of Christ, The Parallax View as well, and of course, you know, we also have The Return of Frasier.
But that's good.
I'm not buying a subscription to Paramount Plus to watch Italian Job series. I'm just not.
No. It's no. it's slightly overwhelming at this stage. I think it's fine to pick one or two out of the kind of sleuth of announcements that you've got coming up. I just got completely lost yesterday when that came out. And as we say, it's not too UK focused.
But also, like, so Mission Impossible is going to be on Paramount Plus after 45 days, presumably only on there for an hour or two because it will self-destruct.
Is that an additional rental cost as well, or is that included in there?
I don't know. They haven't actually said. Good question.
But they do have tiered pricing, and you have to pay a higher price not to have adverts. So that's also a worry, because one of the good things about streaming at the moment is, you know, no freaking ad breaks. If streaming services also have ad breaks, you're just a bit like, oh, I can't bother with this.
Have we had enough in lockdown of tears? Honestly, no more tears, please.
No more tears.
No more tears.
Right. Is that it for movie news? No one carked it, did they?
God, I hope not.
I hope not after you've said that.
If you're a famous Hollywood type and you carked it in the week and we haven't mentioned it on the podcast, then our deepest apologies and condolences and sympathies to your family and friends. And we will talk about you, whoever you are, on next week's show. Time now for this week's second guest. And Sapa, which is a hefty 2+ hour documentary dedicated to the life and work of Frank Zappa, the legendary musician, is out this week, and it is directed by Bill S. Preston Esquire himself, Alex Winter. And I didn't know a lot about Frank Zappa going into this. I knew he was a bit mad, and he named his daughter Moon Unit and one of his sons Dweezil. And that was pretty much all I knew about Frank Zappa. I am now illuminated, and I think it's a very, very good documentary indeed. And I haven't talked to Alex Winter yet. This is going to happen after we record this show, so I hope it went well. And here's Alex Winter. Enjoy. Delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the director of Zappa, Mr. Alex Winter. How are you, sir?
I am well. I'm happy to say, given the craziness of the world we currently live in.
It is crazy, isn't it? But there's light at the end of the tunnel, and I think for once it may not be a train.
Yes, here's hoping.
How are you doing at the moment? How's your pandemic been? I know you had to finish SAPA in the pandemic. That must have been surreal.
Yeah, it was a strange year beyond the obvious for us, because we've been working on quite a few films over the course of the last bunch of years that all came out at once, and all came out at once during a pandemic. So we were releasing Bill and Ted 3, which was, you know, intended for a global theatrical release that had to be completely reimagined at the last minute. Zappa, which we'd been on for 6 years, which also had a global festival tour that was going to be followed by a theatrical release, all of which had to be completely scrapped and reimagined. And then we had our documentary Showbiz Kids, which came out on HBO and in K on Sky. And that one was okay, cause it was sort of built for cable. But it was a very complicated year for us, because we had to, you know, navigate distribution, in this climate. I will say gratefully that all of it worked out for us, and that the films did quite well. People seemed to like them and they were seen. So at the end of the day, we were very happy with the results, but it was a lot of work and very tiring. I think me and my whole team just basically collapsed over the holidays. So,
did you get that thing? I've heard a lot of directors have told me this over the years, that their immune systems just seem to know when you have finished a project, because they just crash, and then you get tired, you get sick, it just all floods in at the same time.
That is 100% accurate. I mean, and I've been like that. You know, I've been in the business my whole life since I was a little kid, it's always been that, you know, at the holiday, everybody crashes. You know, it used to be, you know, my wife used to laugh at me. I had a production company in the UK, and I would sort of go over and, like, you know, knock out all this work. And then, you know, she'd get me when I was sick. You know, I'd go home and just collapse. And that's kind of production life in a nutshell. But yeah. I mean, with COVID, it really is a whole other level of stress. I mean, your brain is just constantly going. But then there are real world issues that you're having to deal with. You know, I have a family. I'm like dealing with getting my kids through school or whatever. Am I worrying about my mom, who's older, and I can't get to her, and she can't get to me? Like, there's all this life happening around you while you're like, but what about my movie?
It's true. Yeah, it's true. It must feel bad. It was like, should I feel bad for being invested in how my movie is being perceived? No.
Exactly. Yeah.
Of course not. Of course not.
I've only been working on this for 20 years, but, you know,
yeah,
precisely. Who's counting?
You know, SAPA in particular is something you've been working on for a long, long time.
It is. Yeah. We started on, we had the idea to do it in 2014 and approached Gail Zappa, Frank's widow, who has also since passed on, sadly. Mm-hmm. And I pitched her a take, and we were lucky. She really liked the take. They're tough customers, and she had been pretty protective of that legacy. I mean, even while Frank was alive, she was, you know, she ran the independent label that they had, and was very, very smart lady, and did some pretty extraordinary things. So I was aware of what I was walking into, but we were lucky. She really liked the take, and the sort of blessing and curse was she offered me access to the Zappa Vault, which was, you know, like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, just this giant collection of rooms filled floor to ceiling with boxes of media and props and art and photographs and every conceivable form of video, every conceivable form of film and audio. And I literally took a deep breath and went and raised a chunk of money on a crowdfund campaign, and spent 2 years day in, day out preserving that media before we could even start the film. It was an insane process, but it was rewarding.
The finished product, how much did it differ from the movie you had in your head before you knew you had access to these archives?
It's interesting. I you know, the thing I pitched to Gail from the very beginning was making something that that would be intimate, that would not feel like kind of an outsider's perspective. And that was why that was why Gail offered up the vault, I think, because I think she felt there was no way to do that by just trawling for external media. And of course, you do still do that. We got media from all over the world. We went on a hunt for years and just got everything we could get our hands on. But the finished film was much more from Frank's POV. Because one of the things that I found down there that I don't even think Gail or the family knew was there was just hours and hours and hours of video and audio of Frank talking intimately with his friends. And that once Mike Nichols, the editor, and I got our hands on that stuff, mm-hmm. we realized that that was the movie. And we basically built a structure out of that material. And of course it's cheating like crazy. Like we're creating sentences that don't exist. We're cutting out people that he's talking to. It sounds like kind of an intimate monologue in the film, which of course it isn't at all. And that was very complicated work, but it gave us a real, direction and sort of sense of what the structure of the film was going to be, because we had the man himself and it's beautiful stuff.
And how much of a cue did you take as well from his musical style also? Because this looks like it was an incredibly difficult editing job. You embrace a style that I wonder if you're deliberately echoing sometimes that very, very intricate musical style of Frank Zappa would have, because there's some incredibly intricate editing techniques used in this movie.
It was a combination of things. One, it was we had a real desire to make a film that was cinematic. You know, mm-hmm. I don't come from a background of making music docs. It's not to say I don't like them. I actually, there are several music docs that are some of the most influential docs for me of any genre. But it's just not what I tend to make stories about. Figures in culture who have an impact on that culture and the politics and the societal aspects and the cultural aspects of their lives. That's really the type of stuff I do. That was why I wanted to make a doc about Zappa. It wasn't so much he was this mustachioed weird rock guitar player. And so I knew I wanted to make something cinematic that had its own visual style and that told the story in an interesting way in reference to the times that it was relating to. But to a point, yes, we took our cues sometimes from not only Zappa's compositional style, but also his editing style, because Mike and I found a lot of footage in the vault that he had filmed and cut himself. He started his artistic journey began as a filmmaker. He was young, but so was I. So was Mike. Mm. So are many people who make films. I started with 8mm. I would buy 8mm films of like old B movies, and I got rewinds when I think I was like 8 or 9 years old. I started, and I would just start recutting those when I was a kid. And then I got an 8mm camera, started shooting stuff. I started cutting that, and then I would intercut it. And Mike Nichols, the editor, the same. You know, I first started working with him. He had an 8mm camera on his bookshelf and a bunch of film, and it's not uncommon. And that's how Zappa started. So we both felt a lot of kinship with that Frank. Mm-hmm. That version of Frank. Mm-hmm. And we took our cues from the way he would cut. And the way he would cut was really specific. So that was very helpful for us. And we also liked it aesthetically. We thought it was interesting.
I was talking about Frank Zappa's music there as if I'm a huge expert, Alex, and I'm absolutely not. I went into this movie.
Good, though. You're our audience.
precisely. But that's really interesting. I had the same conversation or a similar conversation in terms of intent with Edgar Wright, who a few weeks ago on the podcast, who directed, of course, a documentary about Sparks called Sparks
Brothers.
Which
I saw, he slipped me a copy of that, and it was absolutely fantastic.
Excellent. I haven't seen it yet.
It's so good. Oh my God, it's so good. You're going to love it.
Oh, fantastic. Because again, I said to Edgar, I don't really know a lot about Sparks and I don't really want to know a lot going into it. And so was that again your attitude going into this? That you wanted to ensnare people who didn't really know anything about Frank Zappa other than the fact that he was a guitarist, he looked crazy, and he named one of his kids Moon Unit, which is what I knew about him going into this?
Without a doubt. I had no interest in making a piece of fan service whatsoever.
Yeah.
And that, and to be fair to the fans who I have great admiration for, they've got, you know, they've got all that stuff. Like they, you know, they've got all the albums. They've trawled YouTube for every piece of archival they could get. I knew the Zappa fan base would probably like the film because we had so much archival they would have never seen. But I wanted, I would never have devoted 6 months, 6 years of my life to something just because I liked the band. There's no way. I just don't have that kind of time. So, for me, Zappa is an extraordinary human being who lived in an extraordinary period of time, who was very engaged with those times. And I was very interested in making a film about art and what it means to make art and what it means, practically to make art in terms of the cost of that, the financial cost, the human cost, the cost to your family, the cost, the political cost to how you can become an enemy of the state just by virtue of the fact that you make art. Those are themes that interest me very, very greatly. And that was what motivated me to make the film. And that was the audience I had in mind, was who would find that interesting. And the fact that it was Zappa is not an afterthought because it's obviously critical, but I was not making it for Zappa fans as much as for people who would find his life compelling.
Would you mainly consider yourself these days a director of documentaries? I mean, I know you've directed feature films in the past. I was delighted to discover recently, I saw your interview on Jimmy Kimmel, that you had directed aspects of Jimmy Kimmel's show as well, which is amazing. So you've directed a whole bunch of stuff throughout the years, but these days is your focus purely on documentaries?
Well, I do love the form, and I do want to keep going, and I have a production company that I have built that's specifically designed for making docs. And you know, we live in extraordinary times, and I love telling stories about these times and these issues. And the doc I'm starting now is all about specifically the times that we're in, which I've been wanting to do for a while. But no, I'm interested in doing, you know, there's a feature that I'm developing that I'm hoping to direct next year. And I'm writing a couple of shows for TV. I'm even writing some stuff for TV that I would act in. So I do love narrative, and I'd like to keep a foot in narrative. But I would say that the documentary form is a particular love of mine, and I don't intend to stop making those.
When Bill and Ted Face Music came out last year, I had a long conversation on the podcast with Ed Solomon. I asked him whether he or Chris had discussed directing that movie at any point as their grand farewell to Bill and Ted. Did it ever occur to you at any point? Was that ever a prospect for you that you might direct that movie?
We discussed it really early on. I really had no interest in directing it. It sounds weird because Bill seems like such a completely mindless character, but he's not particularly easy to play. And it takes a little bit of brain grease. And I also knew that we were going to have to play ourselves as all these different versions of ourselves. And the notion of playing regular Bill and all the different versions of Bill and wanting to really give those proper attention and directing and working off of Keanu, it seemed like it'd be biting off more than I could chew. And I just didn't want to try to juggle that many balls. I'm really glad. And really on day one, I mean, A, we ended up with Dean Pariseau, who is infinitely more talented. I mean, I'm sorry, but he's just, he's a comic genius. I am not a comic genius. So we really got lucky with Dean, and he did an absolutely incredible job. But it was on day one of set. I was looking at Keanu and he was looking at me. I mean, it was really fun. It was very hard. It was very taxing physically to make the film.
Yeah.
But it was really, really fun. But it really relies on us just being in our own little Bill and Ted bubble. And you can't do that if you're focused on all of the roles of directing. That's impossible.
Yeah, I can imagine it would be.
I mean, for me, I'm not Orson Welles, okay? And I guess it wouldn't be impossible if you're Orson Welles.
I don't know. Listen, Orson Welles was very, very talented, Alex, but I don't think he could play Bill S. Preston Esquire somehow. I don't think he
would. Hey, you know what? That's true. Yeah. When did we ever see him, you know, him dressed up as his grandmother? That's what I'd like to know.
Almost never. Almost never.
That's right. Almost so, never. Yeah.
So say, for example, had you directed that movie, how many takes do you think you would have given yourself of the line, "Ted, you have had many counterintuitive ideas over the years, but this is by far the most counterintuitiviest of them all, dude," which is one of my favorite lines of the last few years.
Yeah, it was my favorite when I read the script. I was so happy it was mine. I didn't have to beg Keanu to let me say it. You know, if I was directing that, I would have waited till the actor got it right once, knowing he would never get it right again. That would have moved the heck on. That's what I would have done, which is exactly what Dean did. He's like, okay, you got that out. We're moving on before you screw it up. I'm like, thank you.
And that's lunch.
Exactly.
Yeah. It is a crack of line. A crack of line. And I think on that note, Alex Winter, I will let you go. This has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Cheers, man. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so that was Alex Winter, and Sapa is very, very good. I really enjoyed it, and I'm now of a mind to track down some Frank Zappa music when I finished listening to a certain song from a certain episode of WandaVision. No spoilers. If you want spoilers, just tube it. No, stop it. Stop it. Anyway, time now to dig deep into this week's releases. And I say this week's releases, a couple of these, in fact, one in particular has been out for a couple of weeks now. It is Dead Pigs, which is streaming on Mubi. It's only available on Mubi. There's another one you got to sign up to, folks. But it's well worth it. Mubi's fantastic, as we have said before on the podcast. You know, they have basically a different, incredible movie from world cinema every single day. But they're beginning to branch out a little bit more into distribution as well. And one of the first movies that they're really properly distributing is, as I said, Cathy Yan's Dead Pigs, which has the unusual distinction of being released after her second movie. So this is Cathy Yan's debut movie, but it's been released a year after her second movie, which is Birds of Prey and The Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn. Got caught up in all sorts of rights entanglements. That's basically why. But is it, Beth Webb, worth the wait? Tell us about this one.
Well, as you say, it's a funny little curio, because you are, or a lot of people will be watching it having already seen Birds of Prey. So you'll be looking at scenes in it, and you can absolutely see watching it how this paved the way for Birds of Prey, especially in terms of her world building. So a little bit of context. It's so Cathy Yan, she used to be a journalist and spent a lot of time reporting in China. And while she was in China in 2013, there was an incident where the corpses of 16,000 pigs came floating down the river Hangpu. I hope I'm saying that right. They'd been dumped illegally from farmers in kind of poorer provinces, and it just started sort of showing up. And so she took the story and turned it into this satire. It's a kind of multi-narrative ensemble that's sort of more of a social commentary on gentrification in Shanghai. And it's so visually creative and intuitive, and a really, I think you'll just watch it, you'll see frames of it, and you'll see exactly how, and it's not an easy string to tie between a social satire based in Shanghai and Birds of Prey, but you can see the way that she creates these kind of fantastical, satirized, hyper realities for her characters. And it's so interesting what she's done in that respect. It's got Vivian Wu in it, which is, she's not the lead character in this, but you can certainly tell that the spotlight's kind of been reserved for her in this. She's definitely a favorite of hers, but it's really bright and bold. It does incredible things with the aesthetic. I was really impressed to see it. I don't know how I would, I've been thinking about how I would feel if I'd seen it before Birds of Prey, and I just can't detach them really, which is probably a good thing.
Yeah, I think, but you can see, you're totally right, you can see just her eye for just style and character and just a cool image, you know, that house in the middle of the sort of wasteland is amazing looking. Some of the neon drenched nighttime scenes are gorgeous. And it, she has a real kind of wit about her, because this is billed as a comedy drama. And it is, for me, definitely more on the dramatic side. But there are some really funny moments scattered in here, which kind of make it a bit more bearable is the wrong word, but you know what I mean? It could be very heavy, because it is dealing with some very, very heavy things. And I think she just gives it just enough lightness to kind of lift it up. So yeah, I liked it. I thought it was interesting, but it is impossible to sort of see it now I would have liked to have seen it as her debut and sort of had that impression of it as an exciting young filmmaker. And now I'm sort of judging it in relation to, how does this lead to you getting a big film deal? How does that work, you know? So, and you can see it. I think you can see the talent there. So yeah, I enjoyed it.
So we give this one 4 stars. 4 stars then for Dead Pigs, which, as I said, is available on Mubi. And as I trailed in the last 2 weeks, actually, we were very, very close to getting Cathy Ann to come on the podcast, but sadly she's now working on something else, so weren't able to make it happen this time around. But hopefully next time we'll be able to have a nice old chat with her about Birds of Prey and Dead Pigs and sundry other animals as well. 4 stars then for Dead Pigs. Next up, it is a movie that I was surprised was even coming out this week, to be honest, because I've been waiting for news of the next movie from Lee Daniels, which is The United States versus Billie Holiday, for ages. And all of a sudden, here it is. And this is, I guess, the new reality in which we're living at the moment. There's a lot of movies coming out, and sometimes they'll appear without warning, pretty much. And it's going to be on Sky Cinema as of this weekend. Hell's Bells, tell us about this one.
So this is Andra Day, the singer, starring as Billie Holiday. And it sort of covers really pretty much the second half of her life. So she is a star. She is established at this point, and she is increasingly under fire from the FBI and law enforcement authorities, who are essentially scared of her activism and particularly scared of her singing Strange Fruit, the song about lynchings, that they see as a, you know, having potential to start riots, basically, even though, you know, we don't see that happen anytime she sings it, but whatever. So Harry Anslinger, the FBI agent played by Garrett Hedlund, is kind of leading the push against her and trying to encourage local authorities and his own men to surveil her and to arrest her on any pretext that presents itself. For example, her use of drugs, because she did suffer, unfortunately, from drug and alcohol addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically a sort of a bit of a trip through her life. So the kind of vague framing device is a sort of a frisson of attraction that she has with Trevante Rhodes' character, Jimmy Fletcher. And their sort of story bubbles under while she goes through other horrific relationships with terrible, terrible, terrible men. But it doesn't, I'll be honest, this film feels a little bit like it doesn't really have a point at times. It kind of feels very meandering and a little bit unfocused in a way that I think does Andra Day's performance a disservice, because I think she is astonishing. She is absolutely wonderful. She doesn't have a huge back catalogue of acting work, but she is off the charts good here. And the film around her is just kind of there. And, you know, it messes with history a few times in ways that actually feel like they go against what it's trying to say. So I don't even know what they were trying to do at times. So I find it a little bit frustrating as a film, but really, really compelling as a performance. And it just made me want to go back and watch Lady Sings the Blues and certainly read up some more on Billie Holiday and definitely listen to some more Billie Holiday and some more Andra Day, because her her performances as Billie are incredible, but her own voice is amazing as well. So yeah, the music is great. The performance is great. I just didn't always love it as a film.
Yeah, this is why I was interested by it, because I've seen Andra Day's name in Oscar conversations.
Yeah.
And Beth, what's your take on this performance? Do you think it's likely to be nominated?
Well, yeah. I mean, we're always in capable hands with Lee Daniels. Trevante Rhodes is you couldn't stop him being charming and easily becoming if you paid him. So I think we're in capable hands both in those respects. I think Andra Day, considering what an incredibly tumultuous and physically and emotionally demanding role this is, this is where the biggest gamble was, as much as I enjoy her singing, that she is able to so readily commit to it and bring new dimensions to a story that I already know a fair bit about, and I'm certainly learning more and more about the power dynamics within women in the music industry, especially at the moment with all the kind of stories emerging around female public figures and how tied up they are in so many layers of kind of patriarchal prison. Men.
Hey.
But
hang on a second. So,
hashtag all men, says Beth.
Every single man. She was able to bring such depth to it, to a story that you can kind of colour in most of the kind of outlines of. I do agree with Helen, it's quite meandering, and certainly some of the scenes that step outside of her reality and step outside of her timeline feel like they're pressing into a larger narrative. I feel at the moment where we are seeing a very heightened, I'm careful how I'm saying this, obviously, but we're seeing a very heightened sort of depiction of the torture of Black people. And I feel like that balance is yet to kind of write that itself in the stories that we're seeing. So I think in that respect, it's tough, but I think that she gives a big service to this story, definitely.
Last but least this week, we have Arch Enemy, which is a sci-fi / superhero flick that is released this week on VOD and stars Joe Manganiello, Jimbo, who is the person who obviously most resembles Joe Manganiello in this group.
We are often mistaken as twins.
Yes, it's the flowing mane. That's what it is.
It's because you both played D&D, isn't it?
Yes, together, regularly.
Do you think you've ever played with him in like a Warcraft session? Because he's a massive geek, isn't he? He's a big old nerd.
Do you reckon he was part of my guild once, that me and he might have raided the dead mines together? Not a euphemism.
Yeah, maybe.
Could have happened. Maybe. Headed down to Black Rock depths of a Saturday night. Quick run around the Scarlet Monastery.
He's a big old fucking sexual nerb.
Yeah. Love a nerb.
Yeah.
He gives nerbs a good name, though. If all nerbs looked like him, we'd rule the world.
You kind of do, though. But anyway.
Absolutely true. Anyway, so Arch Enemy. Oh, God. Okay, right. So this is written and directed by Adam Egypt Mortimer, and it does star fellow nerb Joe Manganiello as a homeless drunk who also happens to be a hero called Max Fist, which is what I'm changing my name to after this podcast. So Max Fist crashed into this reality from another dimension called Chromium while trying to save his world from the evil Cleo Ventric and her doomsday machine. Or so he says. Now, clearly the source of his power, which is cosmic dust, doesn't actually exist in our reality. So instead of being a superpowered hero with the ability to fly, he's just a homeless guy with the ability to essentially drink Jack Daniels and vomit. So meanwhile, Skylin Brooks and Zoli Griggs are siblings. They are Hamster and Indigo. He's a high school dropout and a kind of wannabe citizen journalist, who's, let's be honest, more professional than any of us. And she sells drugs for the local crime lord known only as the manager. Now, when she steals money from the manager to make a fresh start, his goons come to extract revenge. And that is when Max Fist steps in and leads the pair of them on a rampage of revenge and a street war as a kind of hobo punisher. Now, this film is a lot weirder than it sounds, and it sounds pretty fucking weird. So it has these kind of semi-regular comic-inspired, weird animated visual interludes, and the whole film feels deeply strange. But if I'm honest with you, not in a good way. Like, it feels like it's kind of going for, I guess, that pulpy bottom shelf early 90s video store type vibe, you know, except it's also a bit boring because the action sequences are very uninspired. There is a fight between Joe Manganiello and A.N. Other Goon, which is kind of semi-slow motion. And that's fine if you're going to do, you know, Chad Stahelski style, you know, John Wick choreography, but it's basically just people slapping guns and trying to punch each other. It's not particularly impressive. And it doesn't really inspire. And then you've got those kind of slightly limp action sequences. You've got characters which are, yes, demented, but also paper thin and pretty unconvincing. And I think even if Manganiello himself is actually rather fun, and he genuinely is quite fun as Max Fist, and let's be honest, who couldn't be if they were playing Max Fist? But like the final act is at points is deranged, but also really unsatisfying. And I kind of felt like watching this was a bit like snorting cosmic dust, you know, like is this weird sort of trippy, super lo-fi feeling little head fuck of a movie. But I just don't think I can recommend it as a way to spend an hour and a half.
I thought it was a really clever way of telling a superhero movie story on about 50p in a packet of crisps. But at the same time, like, I feel like if that's all you've got, you know, and they clearly do have budget limitations, which I think the premise of the film very cleverly kind of gets around. but you then have to have the sharpest script, and you have to have a really, really clear sense of what your story is, who your characters are, and they have to be really different and memorable, and you have to avoid cliche to really make something like this work. And they kind of haven't done any of those things. And that's the shame. So it's for me, it's a noble failure. Like, I really like what they tried to do. I think it's really interesting, but it does lag and sag at times because you want more of the characters and you want more of the dialogue, and you just want more, you know, care and attention to that kind of detail that really isn't here.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
I completely agree with it. I feel like the script needed to be more confident and honed in on more, but it also just tries to borrow too readily. I mean, from the opening shot, from the opening, there's animated sequences which have these dazzling palettes, but instantly I'm thinking of H.P. Lovecraft or Frank Miller, like, without fault. And I'm sure that's what Adam Egypt Mortimer is trying to head for. He's plummeting straight for that kind of bone crunching midnight madness, but without the energy and the confidence to lean into that mayhem, which was really disappointing. I just felt a constant lack of energy. I was trying to compare it to things like Crank, where you've got that real sense of chaos, that real scrappy DIY, which again had no budget, and you know, that film would not get made today with Jason Statham, but it had that real commitment to chaos, that real sense of frantic balls to the wall. I mean, Glenn Howerton was in that as well, being, you know, slightly less demonic than he is in this, but it just felt diluted and lacked that kind of real commitment to what we wanted there. It was a shame.
It is a shame. But like something like Crank, like, you're right, it's low budget. It doesn't feel cheap. It feels economical, but it doesn't feel cheap. This just felt really cheap. This felt like film school cheap at times. And I think part of that was the aesthetic that they went for, but no.
No.
I got a bone to pick with Max Fist, that's for sure. But just not to his face, because look at the size of him, Christ almighty. Sounds like you're all in the two-star camp then for... Arch enemy. And on that note, on that sad, slightly disappointing note.
Oh.
That is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun as we burst into March in style, because we'll be joined by... Eddie Murphy. Oh, yes, indeed. Eddie Murphy, star of Coming to America and also Coming to America. Very, very exciting indeed to have such a legend on the podcast. He was just as excited to talk to me, folks. Let me tell you.
Sorry.
Hashtag not all podcasters. But until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from our squadcast names, Swindon's Reckoning, Beth Webb.
Sarah.
It's goodbye from Spider-Man Home Secretary James Dyer.
Let me leave you with another 38 facts about Groundhog Day. Now, first of all, the thing you should know about groundhogs is, don't worry, I'll save them for next week.
No!
This is an epic standoff between someone who's trying to make the three-fact structure cease to be and someone who will never, ever, ever rise to the bait. It is goodbye from Spider-Man No Way Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me, Huberto Barada Nicto, which is, of course, the three-letter combination you need to stop the destruction of the world should a spaceship ever land on a baseball mound in Washington. Huberto Barada Nicto. Remember it well, folks. Yes, remember it well. And of course, the words that Bruce Campbell was Klaatu, not Huberto.
Klaatu Barada Nicto.
At the end of Army of Darkness, which some idiots think is the best Evil Dead movie. Not even close. Anyway, I'm off to go for dinner with Billy Piper. If only I could remember the street that we'd arranged to meet on. Damn it. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.